This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Every other year, the Department of Health and the Agency of Education poll Vermont middle and high school students on some of the behaviors that are associated with risk. It's called the Youth Risk Behavior Survey. And in the latest results, 1 in 5 high school students reported binge drinking in the previous 30 days. A new study just published in the journal Nature says it may be possible to predict which teenagers are going to be binge drinkers before they start down that path. The study has close ties to the University of Vermont, including the senior author of the study, Hugh Garavan, an associate professor of psychiatry. And he joins me today to discuss the findings and to talk about what it might mean for young people, not to mention their parents, to know they're at a higher risk of problem drinking. Professor Garavan, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So you looked at, as I understand, about 2,400 teenagers, all white, all European. Why that testing pool?
So the study was conducted in Europe. So about 3 years ago, I moved from Dublin to Vermont, from the Emerald Isle to the Green Mountain State, I guess. And so the project itself was conducted in 4 different countries, in Ireland, England, France, and Germany in Europe. And the reason you mentioned that they're white is essentially for the genetics analysis. You actually need very, very large numbers of participants to find genetic effects. So one strategy that people often use is to try to make the groups as genetically homogenous as possible. So the requirement was that all the participants, that the 4 grandparents of all participants were, you know, of European ancestry.
And so you started tracking these teenagers when they were 14.
Correct. Yeah. So it's a pretty large study. What we did is in these 8 sites in the 4 countries is recruited kids and no special recruitment criteria. This was not a high risk population or kids who were already showing drug or alcohol use. The idea was to try to get as close to a normal community sample as possible. So we recruited in total, as you mentioned, about 2,400 kids at age 14. They were great. They gave us a sizable amount of their time. So we obtained about 10 hours of psychological assessments on the kids. So measures of personality, cognitive abilities, IQ, drug use, mental health. We got some information from their parents on family history of drug use, even in utero exposure during pregnancy. And then we also obtained bloods from the kids for the genetic analysis. And then finally, we obtained some MRI data. So we were able to put the kids into the MRI scanners, and we acquired very high-resolution structural scans, so a very fine-resolution picture of their brains. We could then measure, you know, gray matter, thickness, white matter. But then also we had them perform a number of different tasks in the scanner. So we measured reward systems. So they did a task where they could, you know, play a game and win tokens for M&Ms because they're kids. What that allows us to see what sort of brain systems are involved in reward. We did a test of sort of social processing. So we showed them faces, some angry faces, see how they process those. And then finally a test of what's called cognitive control. So impulse control, being able to inhibit, you know, prepotent behavior. And, you know, this is, I guess, one of the strengths of the study. And I'm, you know, very glad to have been a part of it. Most imaging studies have about 15 to 20 participants. So we have, you know, a couple of orders of magnitude greater than that. And then that allows us to look at individual differences and predictors of future behavior.
And you're actually looking at a lot of different things with this data, not just the study that we're going to talk about today, but in pulling apart this particular study, you've been trying to figure out if you could predict from the data you collected when they were 14, whether or not at age 16 they would be binge drinkers. So what were the actual things that you were looking at as predictors?
Right. So in effect, it's all of the things that I mentioned. So we looked at some cognitive measures. We looked at demographics, you know, their age, their puberty status, their sex. We looked at personality measures. We looked at genetics. We looked at brain function, brain structure. And then we also looked at their histories. So by history, we mean both a family history. So as I mentioned, a family history of drug or alcohol abuse. But then also, interestingly, and this turned out to be a strong predictor, the individual kids' histories, primarily how many stressful events have they had in their lifetime. So, you know, had they, you know, been and fallen out of a romantic relationship, had there been a divorce or a death in the family, those sorts of history measures.
And that was a predictor of being more likely to be a binge drinker if you had had those kind of experiences?
Exactly, yeah. That and, well, I mean, to jump ahead, I mean, a number of those measures that I mentioned actually all survived as contributing some part to the prediction. But certainly the stressful life events was one of the better predictors. That and actually some of the personality measures, they proved to be the most predictive.
And personality measures like what? Thrill seekers?
Precisely. Impulsivity, you know, reward seeking, sensation seeking, anxiety.
So did you weight them then? Were certain factors, I mean, you had all of these sort of variables in there, including, as you said, the brain imaging that you did to figure out brain function and their genetic testing. So were some weighted higher than others when you were trying to figure out what was a predictor of binge drinking?
No, in effect, what we do is we let the data analysis itself try to guide the weighting. So just to step back for a second, obviously this particular study falls within an existing body of research, and all of these things that I've mentioned, as you might imagine, are relevant for teenage drinking, and there are data to support all of them. You know, it essentially kind of stands to reason. We know that, for example, there's a genetic component. We know that there are personality, as you mentioned, sensation seeking and thrill seeking and risk taking. The challenge has been to try to figure out how all these things might go together, and most previous studies just haven't had the luxury that we had, both to have a very large sample size and then also to have this sort of very extensive battery of measures. So what we do is, in essence, all these variables, we identified about 100 or so that we thought would be relevant just based on, you know, our reading of the literature. And then we use an analytic method that essentially identifies which of those measures do actually contribute to the prediction. And then the analytic method itself identifies, you know, which are the best predictors and how much weighting, if you will, to give to each.
And then you ask the kids themselves to self-identify if they're binge drinkers. Is that how you figure out whether or not they are?
Yeah. So basically it's based on self-report. And there's a, you know, it's often, a, you know, it's a bit of an anxiety, but we include a lot of things to try to ensure that the validity of that measure. You know, there are no really good, biological markers of drinking unless we were to get the kids to come in and, you know, give bloods or urines every week or so, which just wouldn't be feasible. But there is evidence to support that, especially actually if you do a computer-based assessment, that kids are likely to tell you the truth. And we can, you know, confirm that to an extent. There are a few things we include when they come into the lab for the assessments, or we have a telephone interview. We ask them some of the same questions again to confirm that they're consistent. We ask the kids about lots of drugs, including some sham drugs that are made up. So if the kids endorse that, then we know that they're just trying to, impress us with their extensive drug use.
What's one of the made up drugs?
We ask them about Relvin. But again, we actually have very few kids endorsing that item. And then also the alcohol use levels that we get, you know, that we get reported are pretty much consistent with what's known about national averages. So it seems like the self-report is reasonable.
We're talking today about the results of a study that looked at whether or not it's possible to predict which teenagers are likely to be binge drinkers. The study looked at genetics, brain function, personality, and family history, and the researchers found that they could predict with about 70% accuracy which teenagers were likely to be binge drinkers at age 16. Listeners, we'd love to know what you think of this study and what questions you have. Would you want to have known if you were at a higher risk when you were a teenager? What do you want to know about your own teenagers if you have kids now? Would it make a difference to have that information? You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We're talking with Hugh Garavan, who's a psychiatry professor at the University of Vermont and lead author of the study. So you have these kids now. You've been able to test them at age 14 and then see at age 16, and you had about 70% accuracy in determining which ones were likely to be binge drinkers. And then you actually tested them against a control group?
Yeah, so what we did, as you mentioned, there were about 2,400 kids in total in the sample. What we did for this analysis was we actually identified 700 of them. So what we wanted to do was identify kids who went on to be binge drinkers by age 16. And we used, you know, essentially an arbitrary criterion, and that was that they had been drunk. They had binge drinked, you know, had at least five drinks to the point that they were drunk at least three times by the age of 16. And what we did then is we identified kids who fit that profile and then who had not had very much alcohol exposure at all by age 14. So at age 14, all our kids reported having had zero, one or two drinks in their lifetime. So that's how we kind of whittled it down to 700 who matched that profile. So approximately.
So the 14-year-olds who had already been binge drinking, you took them out of that sample.
Correct. Yeah, we did a different analysis with them. But for this primary analysis, all the participants, all the kids had, like I said, just 0, 1, or 2 drinks in their lifetime. And then approximately half of them went on and met this criterion for binge drinking by 16, and half of them didn't. And then with that information, we could then go back and look at all the data acquired at age 14, so 2 years earlier, and see of all those measures that we've mentioned, you know, which ones would seem to give some insight into which kids go on to become a binge drinker or not. And, you know, and I guess just to put into context, the big picture here, I guess, you know, I think most kids in Europe and actually in the US have tried alcohol by age 14. And most of the people listening to your show here probably, you know, would, if they were being honest, say that, yes, they too tried alcohol when they were 14. Most people don't develop an alcohol problem, but probably everybody listening to your show knows somebody who did. So that's kind of the big challenge here. What is it about those kids who, that subset, that if they try alcohol, will try it again and try it again and then will start to drink heavily? And then, now we don't have this information yet, but then who might then go on and develop alcoholism? You know, being a regular drinker at age 14, you know, carries with it a risk of about 40% of being an alcoholic as an adult. So this to us is, you know, it's got a clinical question, but it's also quite an interesting intellectual challenge. You know, what is it about those kids who, once they start using, don't stop? And, you know, I mean, I think it's an important question, and hence all the effort gone into trying to track these kids.
Well, and you know, we should say as well, that doesn't mean that you have an alcohol problem that's actually diagnosable as alcoholism if you have tried alcohol 3 times and been drunk 3 times by the age of 16. It may be a problem, but it's not necessarily alcoholism. So some of these kids may be fine going through life.
Absolutely. And that's where it starts to get interesting. So in fact, roughly about 40% of the kids in the sample at age 16 would have met this criterion. So this level of binge drinking is not uncommon. So, you know, it's important that, you know, I don't convey that we have now identified some sort of early test of alcoholism. So far from it. But we tend to think of these things as being on a continuum. So, you know, the more heavy drinking you're doing, the worse the potential outcome. What starts to become interesting now is that these kids are now all 18 and 19 years of age, and we are actually getting them back into the lab. We're doing a much more extensive follow-up on these kids. At age 18, we will probably have, you know, a subset, some group of kids who will meet criterion for problematic drinking and maybe for being en route to alcoholism. And then the interesting challenge, in essence, will be for us to do this all again. So now that we know who are the problem drinkers, is there information at age 14 that would have helped identify them? And then, you know, and is it the same information that predicts this heavy drinking at age 16 that predicts problem drinking or, you know, essentially alcoholism at age 18 or not? So there's a lot more work, you know, still in the pipeline.
And all of the kids have stayed in the study, most of them?
Not all of them. So we had about 1,700 do the follow-up assessment at age 16, and we're in the thick of trying to get the data at age 18. You know, it may well be the case that we might end up with just about 1,000. So, and, you know, this is always a problem. But of course, at age 18, kids are leaving home, going to college, doing exams for university. So it can be challenging. But even if we get 1,000, and then also just as an aside, that raises another really interesting question. And again, just to step back to put that into context, one of the issues whenever you study let's say a patient population, let's say a population with depression or schizophrenia, if you see anything that's different about them, let's say some brain function or some personality measure, you never know if that difference preceded their illness and was potentially a risk factor for it, or if it's a consequence of their illness. And it's very hard. Obviously, you can't do the experiment in humans. We can't randomly assign some kids to drink and some not to. But by doing the longitudinal study, we can do essentially part A, which we've started here. Are there predictors that precede heavy drinking? And then I think you could argue they're probable causal mechanisms. But perhaps even more interesting, once we now get more data on these kids at age 18, we'll be able to identify those kids who, if you will, look perfectly normal at 14 and then whose brains, for instance, or personality or cognitive abilities are different as a function of alcohol and drug use. So then we'll be able to start teasing apart what might be pre-existing risk factors from what might be actual consequences of the alcohol and drug use during the teenage years.
Which would be huge.
Which would be very interesting, yeah. I mean, the teenage years are fascinating, right? I mean, there's, in terms of, so my bias, obviously I've got a particular interest in brain function. you know, there's a lot of changes that go on in the human brain during these teenage years. It's a critical window. A lot of, you know, personalities get established, traits, things like that. But also a lot of mental illnesses emerge during the teenage years. So, and the thinking is that those two things might be related, that you have this ongoing development, this maturation of the brain. And the concern is that, you know, alcohol, for instance, or drug use in an adult may not have the same impact as it might have on a very young, still developing, immature brain. And there are a lot of data both in, you know, some in humans, but also in animal models that suggest that, you know, exposure to drugs might have a different effect in the teenager than it does in the adult. So then that raises the interesting question, well, can we identify those vulnerabilities? Because then you can see how this could all start to come together. Is there a certain vulnerability that someone might already have that then coupled with some alcohol or drug exposure might then lead to long-term consequences?
Well, we're talking about an interesting study that looks at the predictors for whether or not teenagers might be binge drinkers. And we're sort of extrapolating from there to how this data could be used, what other data they're looking at. And we want to hear from you, listeners, about what difference this would make in your family to have this kind of information. What risk do you see in knowing this kind of information about yourself or about your children? Or if you have questions about the study itself, you can call 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We're talking about the results of a study that looked at whether or not it was possible to predict which teenagers were likely to be binge drinkers at age 16. The study looked at genetics, brain function, personality, and history, and the researchers found that they could predict with about 70% accuracy which teenagers were likely to be binge drinkers. Our guest today is the study's lead author, Hugh Garavan, an associate professor of psychiatry at the University of Vermont. And we'd like to hear from you. What do you think about genetics and personality coming together in this study? What difference do you think this kind of research could make for parents raising kids or for healthcare professionals working with families? You can call 1-800-639-2211 with your questions. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. And let's go to Anne, who's calling in from Burlington. Hi, Anne. Go ahead.
Hi. I worked with a student dyslexic population at the high school level several decades ago. And in the research that I had access to back then, that 15 to 17% of the population has some form of dyslexia, which is neurological, blah, 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 blah. And then somewhere along the studies, I found the information that this population was more liable to, or alcoholism. There was a genetic predisposition for alcoholism among this population that was higher than the so-called normal population. I was wondering if his studies verify this.
Anne, yeah, thanks for the call. Professor Garavan?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm afraid we don't have anything to say on that topic. I'm not entirely sure if we assessed dyslexia, but I don't think we did. So we simply haven't included that variable in the analysis. It's interesting whenever you know, we present these results. As you might imagine, a project like this gets decided by committee, and for every one person on the committee, there are at least two opinions on what should be included. So it's always an interesting challenge to try to come up with a comprehensive battery of assessments that fits everybody's criteria. But yeah, no, it's a really interesting question. If the rates are as high as you suggest, and it would be really, it'd be really curious to see what might be the commonalities in genetics and brain function between dyslexia and alcoholism. It's not something I know very much about, I'm afraid.
Well, you did mention that your particular interest in an area of focus is on brain function. And we talked a little bit earlier about how certain personality traits like thrill seeking or sensation seeking can be a predictor of alcohol use, and certain parts of a history, whether it's a family history of alcohol and drug use or events, stressful events in a life of a young person, can also be a predictor. But we haven't really talked about brain function and what brain function areas are significant predictors of alcohol use. Could you talk about that?
Yeah. So there are a few. One that came through that's maybe the easiest to think about is actually total brain volume. So what we found is that those kids at 14 who had bigger brains that actually they were more likely to go on and be binge drinking 2 years later. And just to unpack that, what we think is happening is, as I mentioned, there's a lot of brain changes that happen during the teenage years. But the primary thing that is happening is actually that brains, or at least the gray matter, is getting thinner. So when you're in the first couple of years of life, actually, you have, you know, a massively interconnected brain. And then what happens is over time through what, you know, through your interaction with the world, through the environment, that you get a pruning away of those connections that aren't necessary. So essentially, your brain becomes more efficient, the thinking goes. And what we found is that those kids who seem to be more delayed in that, you know, maturation or that developmental process. So again, they had larger gray matters, and the ratio of white matter to gray matter, I should just clarify that. What happens is the gray matter, if you will, thins, the white matter increases. So you get more efficient brain regions talking to one another better, is the okay. thinking. And so kids who were more delayed, if that's the right way to think about it, were more likely to be drinking years later. And so, you know, it's interesting. Again, it could be the case that some alcohol exposure at a very young age, when you're still in that critical early development, and perhaps especially early if you have this, you know, neurodevelopmental delay, that that proves consequential and then influences behavior subsequently. So so that was one sort of take-home message. And actually, just as an aside, one of the curiosities that came through is that there was this hint that those kids who were more likely to go on to become binge drinkers had this neurodevelopmental delay, but they scored higher on puberty. So you almost get this sort of brain-body mismatch. So they were more advanced in terms of body, you know, puberty status, but more delayed in terms of you know, brain development, which is kind of an interesting one if we can follow up and tease that apart. And then there were also a few more specific brain regions. So there were some frontal lobe regions. Again, frontal lobe is especially interesting. It's one of the last brain regions to develop. A lot of people attribute immature frontal lobe development to the, if you will, the risk-taking, et cetera, of, that, you know, tends to characterize at least some adolescents. So we found some frontal lobe differences in terms of, you know, processing an angry face or in doing that reward task, that there were changes in activity in those kids who went on to become binge drinkers. And actually also, curiously, in some motor brain areas, when you were supposed to try to do that inhibitory control task, a very simple, what we call response inhibition task, you have to withhold responding, that those kids who failed to withhold showed more activity in this motor system. And that, you know, other data suggests might be related to impulsivity, to the, you know, the personality trait of impulsivity. So, you know, we're still, you know, digging deep, as you might imagine. There's a lot of brain information. There's a lot of brain measures we didn't include in the analysis that we're going to go back now and include. So it's a, you know, ongoing analyses for us. I could talk about it forever.
And are you able to determine whether the differences in brain function among all of these subjects are just natural variations in brain function, or are because of something else that's happened in their life earlier before you got to them?
Right. So that's a really, really interesting question. Because one of the things we have not done when we talk about all these different variables is we have not yet looked in detail at how they might interact with one another. So is it the case that if you have a stressful, let's say, early life, and you have this brain difference that you like to become a binge drinker, or do you have that brain difference because you had that early stressful life event? And it's hard for us to disentangle that. Anytime you do a longitudinal study like this, and we start at age 14, you immediately wish you had data at age 12. And once you have that, you wish you had data at age 8 and backwards. So it's one of the interesting questions. I think it's highly plausible that you're going to have lots of interactions, that these early stressors are going to, you know, I mean, you think about that's going to influence your personality, that's probably going to influence your brain. One of the things we want to be, you know, careful about is not to present this as some sort of, you know, predetermined fate that, oh, if there's a brain marker or if there's a genetic marker, then that's it, you're done. You know, you're definitely en route to becoming an alcoholic or a heavy drinker. I think this, the whole system is, you know, is very plastic, is very changeable. Even with our best models, we can't explain all the variants. So there's a lot of individual difference there. So there's nothing, you know, predetermined here. But yeah, to come back to your question, how these things interact, what are the ultimate causes of some of these brain or personality changes. You know, we're getting a handle on, but we don't have a comprehensive answer as yet.
Do you worry, though, that if this were something that was to become widespread testing, say for adolescents, that you get this battery of tests that might help you determine risk factors, that you would get kids who might say, well, the doctor told me I'm likely to be a binge drinker, so what the heck, I'm going to go and have, you know, 7 wine coolers. Is there any sort of sense that this information, should it become commonplace, could actually backfire in a way?
I suppose it's possible. I mean, there is always this challenge as to how, you know, one communicates these types of findings. And of course, in the scientific literature, it comes with all the usual caveats, and the scientific audience appreciates all the subtleties and so on and so forth. But then when you try to publicize it by going on the radio, for instance, there's always a concern that people might take a different take-home message. I mean, we're far away from having anything close to a diagnostic test. But, you know, this sort of information, intervention, if you will. I mean, this is ongoing. So, you know, kids of alcoholics, you know, are told at an early age that really this alcohol is not a good idea for you. If they decide to just stubbornly say, well, you know, whatever, you know, I'm going to do it, well, you know, then that's another issue. But I think as a general rule, having this sort of information, I think, is useful.
And do you give that information to the subjects that you're testing?
Well, we would give general information about alcohol and drug use, but we don't give individual information because, again, our test is not in any way diagnostic on an individual level just yet. And again, all we're doing is predicting binge drinking, which, as you mentioned earlier, is not the same as predicting, you know, future alcoholism. So we don't give that level of information thus far. But I think, you know, in terms of giving information back to kids, to either to individual kids or to to a group of kids, you know, I think my sense is that as a general rule, you know, adolescents, you know, are relatively rational in their decision making. I mean, we've seen over the years smoking going down. Once, you know, people appreciate that, you know, and it becomes kind of non-controversial anymore that, you know, smoking is bad for you, you see, as you see here in Vermont, you know, significant reductions in teenagers who smoke. So I think giving information, and especially if you can ground that in, I'd like to think, if you can ground that in scientific data rather than just, you know, if you will, kind of a moralistic, all drugs are bad all the time for everybody, so just don't never do anything ever, then I think, you know, people would be responsive. And you can also do, if you want to go down the route of targeted interventions, I mean, there are ongoing studies that are showing that this is very effective. So you can go to schools, you can identify not kids who are drinking, but for example, you can identify kids who have, let's say, the personality that puts them at elevated risk of drinking. So, and in fact, you can then have an intervention where you don't talk about alcohol at all. You just talk about your impulsivity. You know, you find kids who score in a very high range. You can design an intervention where you can say, you know, do you appreciate that when you get into this situation, you tend to respond in this sort of highly impulsive way? Here are some tricks and techniques you might think to use. And so all of this, in the absence of any information on alcohol drug use, has then been shown when you follow these kids to reduce their alcohol and drug use. So, you know, you can use this information to benefit on an individual and a group level, I think.
Where do you hope to go next with this research? We've talked a little bit about the fact that you're still studying these subjects, but now that you know that there's a way to predict a likelihood of binge drinking or risk factors, are there other things that you'd like to look at or other studies that you'd like to do?
Yeah, so within this study, obviously we want to keep going. As I mentioned, we want to identify those kids who go on and become, let's say, you know, truly problematic drinkers, see if they're the same predictors. We want to look much more in depth. You know, as you might imagine, there's a lot more we could do with the brain data. There's a lot more we could do with the genetic data. So we're going to continue analyzing these data for, I suspect, for a very, very long time. More locally, actually, what I would be especially keen to do would be to try to do maybe not as large a study, but a similar study looking at something like cannabis use here in Vermont. I mean, cannabis is an interesting phenomenon at the moment. It's becoming, you know, decriminalized or maybe even legalized in a number of places around the country. The levels of sort of general acceptance of cannabis are very high. Vermont scores amongst the highest in the nation, if not the highest in the nation, for cannabis use. I think something like 40% of, you know, 15 to 18 year olds in Vermont have used cannabis. About a quarter report they use it in the last month. So I think an interesting question, again, is not to say, well, you know, cannabis is always going to be bad for all teenagers ever. I think if you give that message, they simply won't believe it. But it may very well be the case that there's a proportion of kids who might be at risk. So again, similar to alcohol, most kids who use cannabis probably do not go on and develop cannabis use problems, but some kids go on and, you know, over a couple of years will progress to using cannabis daily. And then that does become problematic. So what would be really interesting to do would be to do a similar study where we identify cannabis users, follow them for a couple of years, identify those who go on to become heavy cannabis users, and then see if we can understand what are the risk factors for that transition.
Let's see if we can squeeze one more call in here. Tom is on the line from Richmond. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to comment, and your last comments are really right in line with what I was going to say, which is that alcohol is the tip of the iceberg for addictive behavior. And having been, I'm the adult child of not one but two alcoholics and had a lot of stressful home life, I see that, you know, once you talk about alcohol, you better talk about cannabis. Once you talk about cannabis, you better talk about addictive behavior in general.
Yeah, Tom, thanks for that. I hear what you're saying. Appreciate that. And Hugh Garavan, you are looking at other substances, other risky behaviors with the same data that you've collected.
Exactly. Yeah, I think Tom's point is entirely correct. We tend to, you know, categorize drug use by the drug that's used. But very often, I think everybody appreciates that most drug users or heavy alcohol users are polydrug users. We started with alcohol because it's very prevalent. So it's simply, we were able to do the analyses because alcohol is so common amongst the 16-year-olds. But of course, you know, we get extensive data on these kids. We have heavier drug use, illicit drug use, especially now when we get the data at age 18, we will have more of that and we can repeat the analysis. And then we can see, are there predictive profiles for using one or more or different types of drugs?
Well, we'll have to have you back when you have that data. I really appreciate you coming in and talking to us today about this study looking at whether or not it's possible to predict which teenagers are likely to be binge drinkers at age 16. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Hugh Garavan is the lead author of that study. The study team also included Robert Whelan, who's a former UVM postdoctoral fellow in psychiatry and a current lecturer at the University College Dublin, as well as four other colleagues. We have a link to it at vpr.net. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Tobacco may not be the first thing that comes to mind when you think of Vermont, but in the early part of the 20th century, tobacco thrived in the southern part of the state. To combat our unpredictable weather, farmers in this region constructed unique sheds which allowed for the drying of the tobacco leaves. Dale and Darcy Cahill are the authors of Tobacco Sheds, Vanishing Treasures of the Connecticut River Valley. They travel around Vermont, Connecticut, and Massachusetts documenting these sheds and researching the history of tobacco farming in the region.
Early in the 1800s, it was a very lucrative crop, so the farmers grew it like their cash crop, along with their potatoes and their corn and their animals.
And this was actually called Tobacco Valley? The Connecticut River Valley?
Yep. The Connecticut River Valley was known for growing shade-grown and broadleaf tobacco.
The towns in Vermont were Putney, Dummerston, Brattleboro, Westminster, Vernon. So it's really that southern area down there.
Tobacco was being grown in the South back then, right? So this was just another crop that was grown here? I mean, I never knew.
The tobacco that we're talking about is for cigars. And specifically, the shade-grown tobacco was the wrappers. So all of the finest cigars, no matter what was in the middle of them, had Connecticut shade-grown. And Connecticut shade-grown is a kind of tobacco. So even in Vermont, they grew Connecticut shade-grown and then broadleaf. So because of the mild flavor and the light color of the leaves and not a lot of veins, it was completely separate from cigarette tobacco, which is the stuff that was grown down south.
And you're the cigar smoker in the duo, Dale.
Yes.
So is there a terroir of tobacco? If I were a smoker of cigars, would I be able to sense that flavor in a cigar?
Well, I would say 80% of all the cigars that you could buy would have a Connecticut shade-grown wrapper on it.
Oh, so maybe there's a terroir, but you wouldn't know because they're all the same.
Well, you'd have to smoke a lot of them to find one that wasn't. Yeah.
Darcy, what about the sheds themselves? I mean, are there specific things about a tobacco shed that make it unique from any other agricultural shed in the region?
Yes, absolutely. And they are completely unique to this region. They're made exactly the same way as they were made by Polish immigrants back in the 1850s. And they have a special venting system that allows the drying of the tobacco.
In Vermont, in Massachusetts, in Connecticut, where there's weather extremes, these buildings were specific to drying tobacco when it was raining, when it was windy. So the unique barn is unique because of our weather.
And you write in the book about being able to drive around and distinguish a tobacco shed from another shed because of that venting system. You can actually see it sometimes. Yeah. What does it look like?
It depends. There are a couple of different formations of it. But if they're open, you can immediately tell that there are sort of slats coming out of the side of a barn. You can also tell by the hardware. If it's closed up, you're going to see a lot of repetitive hardware on the sides and sometimes funky doors on the fronts.
Every other board in the barn. So some of these barns were 100 yards, 300 feet long. Mm-hmm. Every other board would have a hinge on it so that it could be opened up. So if you can imagine looking down, you know, 300 feet of barn and have every other door open, it has a symmetry that actually is what we found beautiful. But it was so that it would block wind from entering and the tobacco leaves could still dry.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe what actually happens in the sheds with the drying of tobacco?
With tobacco, if it was broadleaf tobacco, you cut it and it lays in the field. Then the workers come and put it on slats, which are sticks, and they're a predetermined length because they will fit in these giant rails that go down the barn. And then they'll stack them in the barn, sometimes 8 tiers high. This is where the slats and the openings and the doors on the barn come in. Based on temperature and humidity, they will open a certain amount of doors and they will start, they light braziers. And in the old days, it actually was coal braziers. Now they use propane and they slowly bring the heat up so that it takes the moisture out of the plant. When these leaves are done and dried correctly, they're like leather. They're supple. And that's what makes the good cigar. That was one of the other things, that walking inside a tobacco shed with all the tobacco hanging is the best smell. It is the smell that every man wants in his man cave. It's just so rich.
So you drove around all over the Connecticut River Valley to try to find these sheds and photograph them. And now in this book, find out a little bit of the history of all of them. There are just 2 tobacco sheds left in Vermont. Where are they?
One is in Putney on River Road, and we just sort of stumbled upon it. And then the other one is in Vernon. And it's part of a dairy farm now, but you can tell from the hardware on it that it was a tobacco shed.
So it's been converted. Now it's used for cows.
Yep.
And in New Hampshire, no remaining tobacco sheds?
Not one.
Not that we could find. You know, there may be one hidden someplace, and if there is, I hope someone tells us about it because we'd love to photograph it, but nothing that we could dig up.
And in Connecticut and Massachusetts, there are actually still tobacco sheds that are used for drying tobacco, and there's still tobacco as a crop there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's probably 200 or 300 of them. And yes, it's still absolutely, we were talking with a tobacco farmer, and they had a bad year last year, you know, with weather, and they're all hoping that this year is a better year for tobacco.
What makes this an interesting enough subject that you would write not one, but 2 books on it?
Well, that is kind of not really a long story, but a funny story. When I was dating Darcy, driving from Vermont to Connecticut, I would see these big barns on the side of the road, and I just couldn't figure out what they were. And they looked a lot to me like our covered bridges in Vermont. And so when I asked her what they were, she told me, and I said, well, when some of them are open, they look really cool. So we took some pictures, we made some calendars, and we sold them. But we also sent a bunch to different publishers. And we also found no one had done this before. So it was kind of a lucky break if you think of how many books are written about covered bridges or lighthouses or other architectural beautiful things. You would have thought everything was covered and there was nothing out there. We checked everywhere.
Well, and Darcy, you know a lot about this agricultural product and this industry as it's happening now, because in addition to the books that you've written and the photographs that you've taken, you're still working on this project. You got a grant to collect oral histories?
We did. We're super excited. We received an Archie Green Fellowship from the Library of Congress, and we've got all of our digital equipment, and we are going to be interviewing. We started our first interview with a guy named Art Aiken, wonderful gentleman down in Westminster, 101 years old. We captured his story, and all of it will get sent off to the Library of Congress and be held there for future generations who, you know, want to learn about tobacco and hear the stories.
What should we know about the modern tobacco industry here in this part of the world?
It really has not changed. Suckering the tobacco, which is stripping off the smaller leaves, still goes on by hand. The way they sew, they use sewing machines to sew the shade-grown leaves together. All of that stays the same. It's absolutely the same as it was 200 years ago.
So it's still a lot of manual labor, it sounds like.
It's not something that's been mechanized. Hands touch one of those leaves at least 15 times, if not more, in the course of its growing and being hung. And so the personnel, the fields are also just full of really busy and really dirty people, because it's dirty. It's because it's sticky, and so the dirt gets on you, and it's – no, it's but they're also little. They're wonderful little extra stories that you discover. For instance, the first cigars that were rolled by women to make extra cash. And Martin Luther King actually spent a couple of summers in Simsbury, in the tobacco sheds in Simsbury, and it was
in Connecticut.
In Connecticut, and it was really the first time he experienced a different racial dynamic, and the North really had a major impact on how he saw his world.
Dale and Darcy Cahill, thank you very much for telling us about this fascinating history and contemporary agricultural look at a product that I didn't know much about here. Thank you.
Thank you.
The Cahills are the authors of Tobacco Sheds, Vanishing Treasures of the Connecticut River Valley. They'll be signing copies of the book at Barnes & Noble in South Burlington on Friday evening. Details are at vpr.net. Fly fishing is a popular pastime in Vermont, and it's intertwined with the state's history. Did you know that former Governor George Aiken has a fly named after him? Well, as popular as it might be, fly fishing isn't easy. So for this week's summer school, we went out with a veteran fisherwoman to learn some of the finer points of casting, how to find a good spot to fish, what fly to use, and where to cast. We met with our expert just outside Burlington at Muddy Brook Park, but her tips have helped her all across the U.S. and in Canada.
My name's Sheila Reed, and I've been fly fishing for about 17 years, more steadily for the past 11. Okay, so the four-part cast starts with the rod tip low, and that's one. And you bring it up a little bit past 12 o'clock. You bring it forward to 10 o'clock, if you're looking at a clock, and you bring your rod tip back down to the water again. The difference between when you're spin fishing and you have a lure on the end of your line, it's the weight of the lure that takes the line out there. In fly fishing, you have something that can be the size of a piece of lint on the end of your line, and it's not going to take anything anywhere. So it's the combination of the action of the line and the rod working together where you get the line to do what we call load the rod so that it can act almost as a slingshot. So I'm going to step down into the river here. And we'll see what happens. One of the nice things about living in Vermont is that if you fly fish, you really can be on a stream within about half an hour easily. So you can fly fish if you don't have a lot of time. You can just get out and have a few minutes, and if you have your gear in the back of the car, and you're good to go. So this place on the river looks like a likely spot, even though the river itself is not known for lots of fish. The current is moving nicely, and there's a nice what we call a run, which is hard to describe, but where the water is a little bit more funneled in. And there is, you can see the bubbles on the top, so there's good oxygenation, and fish need oxygen. And there's moving water, so bugs are likely coming down. So fish need food, and fish need shelter. And you can sort of see there's some big rocks down there where they can kind of hide behind or beside and come out when they need to. And the water will be slower on the bottom than it is on the top, so they can kind of hang down lower and then come up when they're interested in food. In this case, what I'm doing is I'm essentially trying to cover all the water. So I do kind of a grid system. I'll do a short cast out. Remember I talked about this kind of funnel or V shape to the river here? So what I'm trying to do is cover all the water in the V. You need to have some basic knowledge, and there are wonderful books, but oftentimes it's pure dumb luck. I truly believe that because I am living proof that it is often pure dumb luck.
VPR's Taylor Dobbs produced that summer school segment. And don't forget, before you go fishing, get your fishing license. That's it for today. 50 years ago, hundreds of mostly white volunteers traveled to Mississippi to help draw attention to the segregation and oppression of African Americans. Quite a few of those volunteers have since settled in Vermont. Tomorrow on the show, we'll speak with a few of them about their experiences back then and what Freedom Summer and the Civil Rights Movement mean to the country 50 years later. Send your comments or questions to vermontedition@vpr.net and join us tomorrow at noon. Our producers are Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing. We have production assistance from Catherine Hayes. Mary Williams directed the program, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.